Member-supported Jazz 90.1 proudly welcomes you to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites. Call the show now at 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415 or soundbites.org. Now, alongside Steve Ray and Dave Enright, here's Nick Francesco on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Good afternoon, Mr. and Mrs. America, and all the chips in the PC. It is Saturday, the 4th of December, Anno Domini 2010, and you, you lucky people, you're listening to Soundbites. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 4 minutes after the hour, we're going to be bringing you news, views, things to choose, nothing to lose.
Still sounds like I'm talking through my...
Put on your shoes. You are talking through your... Oh, your head, you mean. Oh, I see. I was confused.
Well, it feels funny, you know, in the headset, you know, because you hear yourself talking. It's like, boy, am I congested.
Yeah, congestion is a good way to put that. I had a friend who had your condition regularly and used to call it a sinus headache.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Ooh.
No, I mean the... That condition.
Oh, okay. Now I got you. Thank you.
Oh, I woke up with a sinus headache this morning.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
Things aren't looking...
God. Darn sinus.
Darn, my sinuses are killing me. I can't... My head is pounding. I can't see straight. It's my sinuses. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay.
All right.
Have another one.
Yeah, right. Things aren't looking good for a university student accused of modifying video game consoles. Opening statements were scheduled to begin Wednesday in the federal criminal trial of 28-year-old Matthew Crippen, a student at California State University Fullerton. Homeland Security authorities arrested Crippen last year on accusations that he violated the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. He is accused of modifying Xbox 360 game consoles for money so the machines could play pirated games and other content. This is the first time a federal prosecution for console modding has reached a jury trial. A conviction could have landed Crippen in prison for up to 3 years. A six-woman, six-man jury was selected. Only a few of those panelists said they had ever owned an Xbox or played a video game.
Because they were all over 12.
Yeah. Last week, things got kind of bleak for Crippen and his defense team. The judge ruled they could not use the fair use defense. Crippen's attorneys had hoped to argue that installing a mod chip in a gaming console was no different than jailbreaking an iPhone to allow owners to use software not approved by Apple. Same thing with the iPhone, you know, jailbreaking it. iPhone jailbreaking was okayed under a DMCA exception approved by the U.S. Copyright Office. Opening statements in the case were delayed. And the case was put on hold after the federal judge unleashed a 30-minute tirade at prosecutors. I really don't understand what we're doing here, U.S. District Judge Philip Gutierrez roared from the bench. Gutierrez slammed the prosecution over everything from alleged unlawful behavior by government witnesses to proposing jury instructions harmful to the defense to bringing as witnesses other convicted felons. When the verbal abuse assault finally subsided, federal prosecutors asked for a recess to determine whether they would offer the defendant a deal, dismiss, or move forward with the case. As it turns out, they dropped the suit entirely. Because they simply weren't ready. And that seems to be the case with a lot of these suits. They have very little to stand on, and really, when the judge is up on his or her ideas of these things, it really becomes a bit of a problem for the prosecution.
Apparently, one of the sticking points is that the prosecution has to prove that the defendant knew what he was doing was illegal, and so they had their undercover guy take his Xbox to be modded.
Yeah,
and during the modding,
can you say entrapment?
Yeah.
I knew you could.
During the modding, Crippen allegedly put a pirated disc in the Xbox to make sure the mod worked. And so that was the proof that he knew it was illegal. The witness forgot to mention that during pre-trial discovery. So it's too late to introduce
yes,
that as
is.
Evidence.
Yes, it is. So our question to you, we of course have the poll of the week at soundbites.org. That's bites with a Y. Francis would like us to remind you. The question is, should modifying a game console be illegal? The choices are yes, no, and Marihu, what now? So far, we have 44 votes. And the vast majority of you think it should not be illegal. But, of course, I know that you will have a lot more to say because you think you're all lawyers out there. So when you're done casting your vote, take a look at the yellow box underneath the poll. Click on Give Us Your Opinion. That will take you to my website, which is AskNick.com.
That's AskNick.com.
Where you can enter an opinion. And our question to you, give us a call. How do you feel about console modding? Give us a call at 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Or, of course, toll-free at 1-800-790-0415.
Now, one of the things that Microsoft has stated in their defense about why they consider this illegal is that a lot of the modders put in accelerators, they put in cheats, and so they're getting an unfair advantage on the game.
Right.
Especially with all the network play that's so common these days. And I can kind of see that. It's hard enough for a noob to get online and get killed 20 times in the first second by all the lurkers. But if someone has an unfair advantage with modding their machine, then, so let them all play together.
Yeah, right.
Don't let them into the public.
Would be interesting to set up a game console, a game system specifically for cheaters.
Well, there's no reason they couldn't.
Everyone has all the cheats.
That way, everybody, you go into the room.
I like what your headphones are doing to your hair.
Yeah.
I should have brought a do-rag.
I don't know if that's any better.
A bit of a bouffant.
Bouffant? I washed it and I can't do anything with it today.
Even when you don't wash it. All right, our first caller has hung up.
Okay, we'll try that again. Hold on.
So we'll try it again. So if you'll hang on a minute, we'll get to you. In the meantime, you can give us a call. The number, of course, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Or toll-free, 1-800-790-0415. And we have Dan from Rochester on the line. Welcome, Dan. What's your question?
How you doing, guys?
Good. How are you?
I've just gotten a new second computer. I've got an XP desk unit upstairs, and I've got a laptop with Windows 7. I'm wondering on these thumb drives whether there's any sense to putting portions of the Tango on a thumb drive to use.
No reason you couldn't. I mean, you could have it. Thumb drives are so cheap nowadays. I mean, you can get a heck of 1 gig. The whole Tangle fit on the one
Most,
gig.
The programs, though, typically have to be installed in the host computer.
Right.
So you could use the thumb drive to transport, but not to run from.
Right. Yeah, so this way, if you're trying to go from, say, you got 3 or 4 computers in the house, you can put it on one thumb drive, and you could copy that whole folder to each computer, and then they've all got it, and you can install it as you at will.
I guess I was wondering if there was a problem with one of the computers.
Mm-hmm.
Could I use that thumb drive to resuscitate?
Well, see, here's the thing.
Well, it depends on the problem.
Because, all right, and this has been one of my big issues with thumb drives, is thumb drives do not have locks on them. That's why I've gone to these SIM card. They're like a flash drive, but you put a SIM card into it.
The little
SD cards. Yeah, the little SD cards. Because the SD cards, you can actually lock those. Because what happens is say you go ahead and you put that flash drive in there, and it's one of these Trojans or viruses, and it gets transported back to your flash drive. And now you go put it on another machine and another machine. Now you're just spreading this virus.
You're infecting it.
Yeah. You're just reinfecting it. Whereas if you get these flash drives with the SD cards, you can lock it down, and nothing's going to get back to it.
All right. Thank you much.
You're welcome.
There you go.
Theoretically, if you get a big enough flash drive, do they come in 16 gigs I've seen? Do they come in 32 gigs?
Yeah, they do.
You could actually install a running Windows on it, and then you could boot off of that flash drive to clean your PC's hard drive, which is a lot of times what shops, like Dave and I have to do.
Right.
We have to run that hard drive on another known clean machine because they can be so badly infected, you can't clean it from itself.
Right. We've also had a number of people, Eagle Wolf was one, a couple of others, who actually tried to make a bootable CD that automatically ran the entire Tango. But we found the programs are not designed, or we're not made that way, so it's been very hard to figure that
out. We've tried it, you know, and I mean, with the Tango CD that, you know, we sell, there is, you know, it's all menu-driven. Dan has added a menu to it, and, you know, it's helpful in that way. He's totally automated it, even put our sound effect on it, so that when you boot it up, you know, you hear the soundbite theme song. But, you know, try to do it as much as we can, but like you say, you can only go so far.
There's still a lot of manual
do. You still got, there's just no way of getting around it, folks. It's just the way it is.
All right, our next caller is Steve from Walworth, New York. Welcome, Steve. What's your question?
Yes, good morning. I have a Mac Mini with Tiger installed, and my problem is I opened up my mail, Thunderbird, and all my mail is gone. And it's like I have a new computer. And then I went to my browsers, and I open them up, and it's like I'm starting from the beginning. And then I go to iTunes, and it says, welcome to iTunes, as if, you know, and all my music and everything is gone. It's like I've got new everything.
Are you logging into the same username you typically do?
Because
it sounds like you created a new user folder.
Oh, okay. Maybe I did. The only it was working. I upgraded to the new Thunderbird, and everything was working. And the only thing that I've done since then, before I noticed this, was I installed a program called Log Me In, and it asked for my username and things like that I log into the Mac.
Yeah, that's for remote login.
Yeah.
If you gave it a different username and password, then it probably created a whole new user.
Oh,
it could have, yeah. We've also seen sometimes people will accidentally move their library folder. People will sometimes be looking in their home folder and they don't know what library means, so they'll move it out of the folder. So programs lose all their preferences. One of the things in the library folder are the preference files that tell applications where to look for stuff.
Okay, so I may have done that because before I went to the new Thunderbird, when I do a backup, I copy everything over to an external drive,
mm-hmm.
and I had just done that about a week ago.
Yeah, it's possible that if you missed dragging it to your external drive, you might have moved one of those required folders somewhere else, so now it can't find your data.
Okay.
So in essence, it is a brand new user because you took all your user data out. You can try looking around your desktop, looking around the hard drive to see if you can find an extra home folder, extra library folder. But you may end up having to take it into a shop because it's something you have to see to be able to fix.
Right. Also, if you did back it up just last week, you could just pull that
restore,
library
yeah.
or home folder yeah. back over
what,
again.
And you
back
just use
over
it
into the applications or the...
Well, how do you back up?
Hmm?
What, do you use a backup program to do your backup?
No, I simply copied the my libraries over.
Which libraries?
iTunes and mail.
Yeah, you could copy them back and put them in the right place. And the problem with not using a backup program is you have to know what the right place is. You're better off dragging the entire home folder so that it backs up everything. You get a copy of everything. But if you look in your current home, well, first of all, make sure you're logging into the same username you normally do. Make sure you don't have a second username. Well, it's a good idea to have a second username for troubleshooting purposes, but that mm-hmm. second username is empty, and so
yeah, my username is there because if I double click on the Macintosh hard drive, you know, you get the desktop applications and my username with the home.
So your home folder is right, yeah.
Is so there, and that's right.
It's probably somehow some of those folders in your home folder were accidentally removed from the home folder.
Okay.
So you have to look around your hard drive to find them or copy them back. Now, since you didn't copy everything from the home folder onto your backup drive, you're not going to be able to restore everything either.
Okay. Well, I don't care about anything because I still have all my files. There's files in the desktop that are okay, and my documents are still okay, and they're all there.
Right, but you didn't back up your application preferences. So
okay.
Even if you put the iTunes library back where it belongs, if the mm-hmm. preference file isn't expecting to see that library there, it may not work right.
Okay. That's the only thing I care about is my iTunes. And I had just synced with my iPod.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a way to resync from the iPod so I can get the iTunes back on my...
By design, you cannot sync from an iPod to a computer.
What?
it's to prevent you from stealing someone else's music.
Yeah, which really stinks.
There are
that stinks.
There are third-party programs to allow you to do it. In specifically
yeah,
in this case, if your hard drive crashes or you delete something yourself, you should be able to copy it back. Music that you have purchased from the iTunes store can be synced automatically from an iPod.
Because wouldn't it make, just logical sense? I mean, if you're syncing it from your computer to your iPod, you should be able to go backwards the other way. I mean, why would iTunes have an issue with that?
Because if I take my iPod to your computer, you can steal all my music.
Yeah, but it's the same name. I mean, it's whatever.
Yeah, wouldn't it have to be the same name?
My iPod matches the computer.
Yeah, it matches. It goes by the name.
Yeah.
And if it didn't match the name, I mean, if I just call it iPod... Yeah, that'd be an issue, but mine's labeled Dave.
Yeah.
If I take it over to yours, yours is labeled Steve, you know, and these two names don't match up, why should that be an issue?
That was the decision that the record industry forced onto them.
Bad decision.
Yep. But there are programs. There's one called iRep. There's one called Sanuti. I like Sanuti because it's iTunes backwards.
Yeah.
Because you're doing the function of iTunes backwards.
Okay,
if
there's third parties, I can...
There are third-party things, but also isn't there the if he's got all his music over, can't he just bring it back into a whole new place and then tell iTunes to?
Yeah, he'll have to re-import it into the iTunes library and rebuild all his playlists.
Yeah.
If he's removed his iTunes database.
Right, but if worst comes to worst, it's doable.
Yep.
Okay.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. Back in just a couple of minutes. Dave Enright, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco, and you. 19 minutes after the hour, Soundbites, member-supported Jazz 90.1.
It's America's longest-running computer show. Back to more sound bites with Nick, Dave, and Steve. Next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
I'm Steve Ray.
And at 22 minutes after the hour, we are sound bites. Ransomware is back. Beware, everybody. After a hiatus of more than 2 years, a variant of the GP Code program has been released, kidnapping victims' data and demanding $120 for its return. Like the ransomware programs before it, GP Code encrypts a victim's files and then demands payment for the decryption key. The new version of GP Code, labeled GPCode.ax by security firm Kaspersky, comes with a bit more nastiness than previous attempts. The program overwrites the file with the encrypted data, causing total loss of the original data, and uses stronger crypto algorithms, RSA 1024 and AES 256, to scramble the information. This type of malware is very dangerous because of the chances of getting your data. The chances of getting your data back are very low, said Vitaly Kamluk, malware lab expert at security firm Kaspersky. It is almost the same as permanent removal of the data from your hard drive. Ransomware crops up occasionally. The last known revision of the GP program came 2 years ago. At the time, the author claimed that the scheme pays well, but criminal business model has a number of factors working against it. First of all, antivirus firms immediately analyze ransomware code for errors that could allow decryption. Writing good encryption code is notoriously difficult, and previous attempts of the previous versions of the program had flaws that allowed security firms to help victims recover at least some of their data. And, of course, there's the trust problem. Unlike rogue security software, where the criminal dons the guise of a trusted security company, ransomware is in the business of blatant extortion. How exactly does paying a criminal who has just encrypted your data guarantee its return? No wonder ransomware is rare. Moreover, for the properly prepared company or user, defending against the attack is simple. Just ensure that you make frequent backups and train users to restore data if you're ever faced with a ransomware threat. These days, companies have no excuse for being unprepared. So our question to you, have you been hit by ransomware? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Or, of course, toll-free, 1-800-790-0415. Just like our friend Cindy did from Queensbury. How are you, Cindy?
I'm okay. How are you?
Peachy, thanks.
Good. I need to know how to stop things from starting when I turn on the computer.
What sort of things?
Well, I have broadband to go, and that always starts. Windows Live always starts, but those are easy to cancel.
Right.
I just put Kodak Easy Share on my laptop, and now it wants to start I mean, go all the way to my albums.
Yeah.
Yeah. Pretty much every program that does that has a preference command where you can say, don't launch at startup.
So if you go into the preferences for each of those programs, often they're under tools, sometimes they're under edit.
Sometimes it's called settings instead of preferences.
Right. But you should find a checkbox that either says start on computer startup or don't start on computer startup. And then you either check or don't check it appropriately.
Okay.
If that doesn't work, excuse me, if that doesn't work, then you want to run the msconfig program. From the start button, select run, type in msconfig, which is short for Microsoft Configuration, but it's all one word, msconfig, and hit enter. You'll see a system come, a window come up, and one of the choices, one of the tabs on that is startup programs, and you pick which programs you want to start. Don't go crazy in there, but if there's one or two you specifically don't want to start, you can check them.
Right. I would only check the ones, I would only check those three.
Right.
Because nothing else bothers me, you know, nothing else comes up that I have to close when I turn on the computer.
Right. There's also the thought.
I don't mind all the right. undercover things.
Right. And they should be, most of them should be running, which is why I'm very reluctant to tell people to go into that area, because there's a lot of things you, if you turn it off, your machine stops working. So the other thing is, if you don't use those programs, just uninstall them and they'll go away. But it should be easy enough to tell them to not start at system startup.
Where in preferences? I'm in preferences for
every
Easy Share.
Every program is different.
Okay.
And again, if it doesn't have, and it should, but if it doesn't, I did not look that up.
There may be an extra launcher. Sometimes in your system tray, you'll see an icon for these the different types of programs like this. And you right-click on that icon and go to settings, and that's where you tell it to not launch at startup. So sometimes it's not in the main program. Sometimes it's a helper program.
Okay. I'll look around.
It seems that for the Kodak Easy Share, you pretty much do have to do it through msconfig, because apparently Kodak, in their infinite wisdom, did not feel that it was necessary to give you some form of don't start it on.
I think everyone just says go to msconfig rather than looking in the program itself.
On my desktop, it doesn't start right away.
No, it's probably down in the toolbar.
On my laptop and...
Well, it is probable that it's in there somewhere. I just don't have that software installed, so I can't lead you right to it. But all of the choices, and something will stand out that says either start when the computer starts, don't start when the computer starts.
It's in there.
Begin automatically, always run, you know, something along those lines. Okay,
that it's in there?
If it's not in there, then use msconfig. But like I said, look around and see if one of those is in there.
Okay.
Give us a shot and let us know.
Yeah, it's different on the Mac.
Thanks, Cindy.
There's a global run at startup checkbox you can check on any application.
Right.
So it's easy to uncheck.
I would assume and hope that Kodak gives you an option there, that they don't just automatically take your machine over.
Sometimes it's a helper program waiting for you to plug in your camera. And when you plug in your camera, it automatically launches.
Right.
So she has her camera plugged in. It's saying, oh, there's a camera. I better launch.
That's a possibility.
And which is also a preference, too, about what you want to happen when you plug your camera in.
Right. All right. Our next caller is Jim from Fairport, New York. Welcome, Jim. What's your question?
Hi there, guys. My father-in-law is in his 70s, and I bought him a Windows computer a year or so ago. And he can get on there and get to the internet and stuff, but it seems to just be a sort of a hassle. You know, there's always, he has the an antivirus installed and spyware, but it seems like, you know, there's just as much ongoing maintenance needed to remove pop-ups and things that install themselves from his browser. Is there best practices for someone who's elderly? If you had an elderly family member, what would you set them up for a computer? Would you use Windows or something else? Like in Windows, it doesn't seem like there's an easy way to set all the fonts bigger all at once. You know, you sort of have to go into different places. And to use a program, they're not identified by browser or email. You sort of have to know, okay, Firefox is this, and this program is this. It's just not set up very well, and it seems to leak a lot of maintenance. What would you do?
Well, I think Steve and I have two different answers.
Yeah.
Well, it's part of the issue is you're going to have to train them on whatever computer OS they get. You may find that Windows or that Windows especially has trouble with the pop-ups and malware because that's sort of the nature of what's happened in the Windows world. So something like the Mac or a Linux machine wouldn't have those types of problems.
That's what I was going to say. Believe it or not, for both of you guys, either a Linux box or a Mac.
You're
in this
still,
case,
yeah, you're still going to have to tell them what's what. You can create a shortcut on the desktop that says mail, and that opens the Thunderbird program or opens, you know, Apple's mail program happens to be called mail and looks like a postage stamp, so that's supposed to help.
Yeah, and you folks in the IRC, yes, you can duly note this on December 4th.
Right.
I did recommend a Mac or Unix box or somebody else.
Same thing with the web browser.
Right. It really depends a lot on what your father-in-law is doing online. If he's only doing a minimal number of things, like he's not going to play games and he's, you know, not going to be running specialized Windows software, et cetera, then either a Mac or a Linux box. Now, it's going to take you a little bit to set one of those up. Personally, I'd prefer a Linux box because it has even fewer vulnerabilities that are out there in the common world than a Mac does. But either, and it doesn't update iTunes every 4.5 minutes, which is something. But
So what distribution would you use, and is there a way, would you set it up, it's a relatively new Windows box, would you set it up for dual boot or just get a new hard drive or just overwrite what's there?
It depends on what it is your father-in-law is doing online.
Yeah. What is he actually, you know, he said he's in his 70s?
Mail and browsing, paying bills.
You may, well, it's too late now, but that's sort of the market for the iPad and other tablet devices.
Right.
Where they have a big button that says mail, and it obscures the operating system from you and just lets you run your programs.
Right. But given what you've got, certainly dual booting can't hurt. Because you may want to someday go back to Windows for something else. But if you kept the machine you have and set up a dual boot situation with Linux and set Linux to boot first, which it would do if you created a dual boot using Linux, and then you simplified the desktop so there were only two things on it, just a big icon for mail and a big icon for the web, and name them mail in the web.
And there is a setting in Windows to change your global, it's in the display properties, to change your global font and icon size.
Right.
But it doesn't apply to all the programs. A lot of times you have to
ignore it.
Right, every program has to be set separately.
And that's going to be true in any
operating system, yeah.
Yeah, Mac or Unix.
One thing I have seen people do, and it annoys me because I'm me, you have your screen resolution that's supposed to be, say, 1024 by 768, and they change it to be 800 by 600.
Yep.
So everything is bigger. Everything is also fuzzy, but it's bigger.
Yep.
Yeah, but
on an LCD, that's not the same issue on a CRT, but everyone's got LCDs.
Well, there's also programs. I mean, you know, if seeing things is an issue.
And there's magnification programs.
Yeah, there's magnification programs that you could just install, and it's a one-shot deal. You start that program up, and no matter what he's using, whether it's the mail program or a Word document or anything else, it's going to make everything larger on his screen.
Okay. Do you have a name? Do you recommend one of the packages?
Just do a search on text and logic, because there are some like Zoom Text. Okay. IBM had a screen. It's a screen magnification program is what you're looking for. As a matter of fact, if you go to PC Mag or CNET.com or Downloader.com, you can do searches on there for screen magnification programs, and it'll make it a little bit easier. Matter of fact, Windows 7 already has it built into it.
Microsoft Windows already has a magnifier built in.
Yep.
You go to All Programs, under Accessibility, under Magnifier.
Okay, and then just one last follow-up. So how do I install a dual boot? Does a Linux distribution have that option? Or
yeah,
can
if you were
just
to
give me the summary on how to do that?
Yeah, if you were to just make an Ubuntu CD and boot with it. One of the choices right at the beginning, and you want to read it carefully, it says, oh, I see you've already got an operating system on here. Do you want to wipe it out? Do you want to share the drive? You say share the drive. Right, and so you can do that fairly easily, and then it'll let you set how much goes to Windows, how much goes to Linux, let you set it up, and then it'll bring up a menu at the beginning. Generally, it's a 7 or 10 second timeout. I forget what it is. You boot it up, and you can either pick something out of the menu or just not do anything, and it will in 10 seconds boot into Linux.
Okay, thanks, guys.
Yeah.
There's something called lens mode in Windows 7. So everything under the cursor is just magnified like you have a magnifying glass as part of your cursor.
Yeah. There's a lot of programs that'll do that, a lot of stuff that'll do things like
and
that.
It's under the accessories disability access. The OS X Mac has similar things, too, in their disability section for magnifying the screen. In fact, I see sometimes people will accidentally turn some of these settings on, and you can make your screen look really crappy.
Mm-hmm.
One of my favorites was there's a voiceover feature built into the Mac where it speaks your interface to you, and it puts a little black box around the thing that it's speaking.
Right.
And I had a customer. We were there for another purpose, but he said, oh, by the way, can you get rid of these little black boxes? And when I saw what it was, well, that's the voiceover. Didn't you hear the computer speaking at you? Yeah, but I turned the volume off.
Okay.
But can you get rid of those little black boxes for me?
I forget where it was the other day. I accidentally turned it on. There's some key press that turns it on.
Yeah.
And I said, no, thank you. And it wasn't. It was kind enough to not just turn on. It said, do you want to do voiceover? Voiceover's now activated, and I canceled it. So
Command function F5.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that wasn't what I hit.
Yeah.
At any rate,
what the common one that I have seen people accidentally do is what's called the enhanced contrast, because it's Command Control Option comma and period. So it's sort of all the keys in the bottom right corner.
And that's common, is it?
Well, it's all the keys in the bottom right corner of the keyboard. So
if you slam your hand down,
or you set something on the keyboard,
you can push
those keys on. Yeah. And we've actually had a couple of calls where people have said they thought it was the monitor, so they bought a new monitor, so now they're sure it's the video card has failed. And I get out there with a new video card, and, oh, that's just your enhanced contrast turned on.
Yep.
Because it works fine when you boot, but when you log into your account and it sets your preferences, then it futzes out.
Right. All right. We have 1 minute before the break, so we can at least get the next question in. Our next caller is Linda from Greece, New York. Welcome, Linda.
I had a short amount of time. I got my new computer. I can't do it in a minute.
Give us a question, then we can come back to you.
Okay. I got a new computer, and when I create the shortcuts, go into Internet Explorer and all that, with the shortcuts, it comes to the default one. It doesn't go to the actual icon, if you know what I'm saying, like Twitter. It comes to a white box. It has a little thing in the middle, which is the default, but it's not coming to the actual Twitter icon, if you know what I'm talking about.
Yes, but if you click on the icon, do you get Twitter?
Yes.
Okay, so the problem is the picture.
Exactly. I can go into properties and change it, but that's a pain.
There was a virus that did that, the Windows LNK shortcut virus.
All right, hold on, Linda, and we'll come back to you after the break. Which we're going to take right now, back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco, Linda from Greece, and all of you on the longest-running computer show in the known universe, Soundbites, right here on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Online 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at soundbites.org. More with Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
I'm Steve Ray.
And at 43 minutes after the hour, we've got Linda on the line. Linda.
Yes.
There's a couple of things that can cause this. Do you have a lot of icons on your desktop?
Uh, Well, it's brand new. Right now I've got 2, 4, maybe 10.
Okay, that's not
that's
a lot.
Not bad.
I mean, it's brand new. I just got it yesterday.
Right. It could possibly be a virus, but what it sounds like is that your icon cache has been damaged.
Are all of the shortcut icons missing or only some of them?
Some of them.
And it's all the new ones?
Soundbites, your icon came up, iTunes icon came up, but if I wanted to put Google on my desktop, I had to go, it took about a day, and then the icon finally came up. But now I've got a poker game on here, and that icon came up, but Twitter didn't come up, so I had to go in and create one, in the properties. But some come up, some don't.
What it sounds like is that you've got a corrupted icon cache.
Already?
Yes. I'm sorry.
Already?
2 minutes after hooking up to the internet, you can be history.
It's not. You're going to need to take it somewhere, Linda. It would be impossible for me to explain over the phone.
Well, unfortunately, unfortunately, I didn't buy this locally.
It looks pretty simple.
Well, any place will be. Are you looking at the?
Yeah, rebuild the icon cache.
Yeah.
Oh, you've got a different one. All right, go ahead. Tell her.
You launch the task manager. What Control Shift Escape is that what it is now in Windows 7? It's not Control Alt Delete anymore.
For what? To bring up the task manager?
The task manager. Yeah.
Control Alt Delete.
Control Alt Delete.
Still the three finger salute.
What you need to do is end the explorer.exe process, which is what creates the desktop, and then you're going to run the command.exe program to bring up a command prompt, and there's a couple of different commands. I've posted a link. You're going to delete the icon cache database that's in your app data folder.
Okay, you said you posted a link. Where did you post it? On the Soundbites
website? Yep, soundbites.org under links, yep.
Okay.
Just follow those instructions. You should be fine.
Yeah, I mean, I just got this thing, and I'm thinking to myself, what's going on? I tell you, I ordered Professor Teacher's Windows 7. I ordered that because I figured I'm going to need some help.
Well, try this and see what happens.
Okay, thanks a lot, guys.
Oh, yep. There's also a GUI way. Under disk cleanup, you can delete your thumbnails. That might be easier.
Oh, yeah, that would be a lot easier. So go down. Steve's going to post the link to that one.
Now, this is thumbnail cache. Yeah, every thumbnail of picture, video, documents.
No, that's a different thing entirely.
So it's not your it's not your icon thumbnails.
It's not your icon cache. All right, so
I'll post it anyway.
Yeah, post it anyway, but it probably isn't the right one. All right, our next caller is Robin from Rochester, New York. Welcome, Robin. What's your question?
I have a Windows 7 question. I have a new computer, and when I was working, I had XP. And in my mail, I could do, I think it was Control Alt and hit Delete for, and then just tag the ones I don't want. Is there a shortcut in Windows to do that?
What mail
Gmail
program? In Gmail, you click on the little checkboxes and then hit the delete icon. Next to every message in the message list, there should be a little checkbox.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. And then just move my mouse to the box and then how many I want, and then I can hit delete.
Yeah. Yeah. You can delete them as a group. You can move them as a group into other folders.
Yeah.
All right, I'll go practice that one.
At the very top of the column is also a checkbox, and that will check all of the messages in that list.
Sometimes that's easier because if there's only a few that you want to save.
Yeah, if you're going to delete 20 of them and save one, you
check them all
and then uncheck the one you want.
Okay. All right, great. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Sure.
Bye-bye.
Bye. That was an easy one.
Yeah.
That was an easy one. I'm glad you guys were on it. I was having computer trouble at that moment, which was a little weird.
We should call into this computer show I've heard about.
I hear they've been around you.
I don't even like them. This is one of my favorites. A North Texas man reported on Thursday that his Motorola Droid 2 smartphone exploded next to his ear as he was ending a call, resulting in a bloodied face and a trip to the hospital. Fortunately, no hearing loss occurred, and yes, the phone was actually still working after the incident.
Wait a minute. If it didn't get, it's going to explode. All right. Mr. Wizard.
Usually when people talk about their phones exploding or their computer battery exploding, it just swells a little bit.
Yeah,
this sounded like it really exploded.
But wouldn't heat be involved here?
Yeah, it should have got too hot for him to hold before.
Hello?
The man, well, he's in Texas. Maybe it's that hot all the time. The man, Aaron Embry, said he heard a loud pop from his just two-day-old phone and then felt blood running down his face as a result of the shattered glass covering. He received 4 stitches at the hospital. Motorola issued a statement that it will reach out to the customer and investigate the incident thoroughly. Claims of exploding cell phones are rare, but not unheard of. Apple responded to claims of exploding iPhones in Europe last year, pointing fingers at customers. Battery makers have also come under fire for exploding cell phones. Reports have even surfaced of people being killed by exploding smartphones, though some reports have also proven to be exaggerated.
There's a picture of the bloody phone on the local news website.
Yep. So the question I have for you, are you worried about all that potential energy stored in your phone, laptop, MP3 player, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? You're a walking bomb if you're carrying all that stuff around. Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Or, of course, toll-free 1-800-790-0415. What interests me is the phone continued to work after it exploded. What kind of explosion?
The picture there looks like he dropped it and broke the glass and then held it back up to his ear and cut himself on the broken glass.
Because if the phone is still working, what exploded?
Yeah.
That, there might be more to this story.
I think he's basically mistaken.
Do people in North Texas?
I'll just say mistaken.
Well, let's put it this way. Was there any liquid?
It was 23.
Perhaps he had a sinus headache.
Yes. Could have.
While he was using his phone.
You know, he could have, you know. I mean, there could have been some liquid vibration there.
Exactly. It really doesn't. I don't understand how a phone explodes and then keeps working.
He's 27 years old.
Well, there you are.
And he was at an elementary school in Cedar Hill, Texas.
He might have been drinking.
Doesn't say he was working there. Says he was at the school.
Okay.
Probably some teacher came up, slapped him upside the head as he was making a phone call
and
said, get out of here.
Yeah, broke the phone against his ear.
What exploded if it's still working? I mean, you take a look at the picture of the phone, and there's nothing broken. There's no hole in the case.
Glass is broken. And I've seen, in fact, we have one in our shop this week, where the glass is broken, but the LCD panel isn't, and the phone still works.
And the phone keeps working, but there's nothing exploded there. There's no hole in the case. I think he's, I think when Motorola...
He's a little liberal with the word exploded.
Yeah. A little, you know, over the top. Probably just to get his 15 seconds of fame.
Probably fell off the teeter-totter in the kindergarten schoolyard.
Kid probably pushed him off the swing. Get up! I want to use it.
That's exactly right. I don't. I loved the story, but I do not believe one little tiny word of it.
You think?
Well, then they go on. The local news station out of Houston goes on to report a 23-year-old man died in India when his phone exploded.
See, and now there's an explosion.
And a 27-year-old woman died in China.
There's an explosion.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
None of this, the glass
cracked. Yeah, and I had to go for some stitches.
That's not an explosion.
No.
That's you dropped the phone, you idiot.
Yeah, and you're not, you know, losing part of your limb or, you know, out shreds of, you know, glass and everything else.
The U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission warns cell phone users to keep batteries away from metal objects when the phones are not in use. Keep them away from liquids. Don't let them overheat.
Keep you away from liquids when you're using your phone.
Yeah.
I think Archandra's right. In the IRC chat, Archandra said, needs Mythbusters investigation.
Ooh.
I love the one they did on cell phones, the exploding cell phone at the gas station. They did all they could and could not get the phone to explode.
Right.
It was in a room filled with gasoline vapors. It wouldn't explode.
Right.
Or then, ignite. It would ignite.
Then they got the pantyhose out and rubbed the pantyhose. Boop.
Yep.
Which is what a lot of the news stories have talked about. For some reason, difference between men and women pumping gas, the men will stand there and pump the gas. Women will walk back and forth, get into the car, get out of the car, and – generate static electricity on their nylons, and that's what sparks the gas. And then your first instinct is to pull the hose out, so now the gas is spewing all over your car.
Right. How do you walk away from pumping gas? Because I don't know any of them that let you
Most of them don't lock anymore, so you shove your gas filler cap into it, and it holds it open.
Thank you for that safety tip.
We look forward to your emails.
Jazz 90.1 does not endorse anything Steve Ray has ever said, ever, including that last statement.
So I always make sure I keep myself grounded to the van when I'm filling my gas tank.
You know, that begs the question, why did they take those clips away? You know, to just sit there and allow, you know, if you're filling up your gas tank.
Well, they were originally designed in the days when the Texaco man filled your tank and he could start the gas going and then he'd do your windshield and change your oil and
so what's wrong
buff
with
up your tires. Now they don't want people starting to fill the tank and walking away for the very reason that Steve originally said. They
wearing his pantyhose? I don't want to see Steve. I don't want to see Steve wear pantyhose.
No, we really don't want to see Steve in pantyhose. I, on the other hand, have great gams.
Yes, I know. I have seen you.
Yes, you have, in a dress. But
let me clarify that. Wait a minute. Let's back up here for a minute, folks, because they're sitting there, what? Dave seen Nick in a dress? Yes.
It's better than seeing him out of a dress.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I suppose that's your condition now.
That is. It is. I am out of a dress right now. That is absolutely true.
What was the name of that show that you were doing?
You Must Pay the Rent.
Yes. And it was a two-person.
Or I'll Show Up in a Dress.
Or I'll Show Up in a Dress. Yeah, but,
and he did.
There were a bunch of us. It was a musical
show.
Melodrama.
It was great.
Very funny, funny, funny show.
It was. Laughed our
great
butt
people
off.
Great people in the cast. And I played a dual role. I played Clem and Mama.
Yep.
I believe I did. When I played it here in Rochester, I did not have a mustache or a beard.
No, you didn't.
No. In fact, that's when I shaved it back when my daughter, when I was about two. I shaved it off.
Did your daughter get terrified?
She was two.
Oh, see.
I made her watch. She would get it, and she still screamed and ran away and wouldn't come near me.
Mine did that too, Amy.
Yeah.
When I shaved it, because I had a full beard one time, and I shaved it off, and, you're not my daddy! He went screaming out. And
I realized, had I only done that like a year earlier when she was still in diapers, year and a half earlier, when she was still in diapers, I wouldn't have had to change them anymore.
Yeah.
Good point.
If only I had thought of it. So all you
Where
new
was
dads,
Captain Hindsight when we needed him?
Exactly. You guys out there with pregnant wives, grow a beard right now. And when that kid is 6, 8, 10 months old, shave it. Mm-hmm. You'll win.
Yep.
Because I discovered, you know, I changed the first one, the green one.
Ooh.
And I thought, I told Elaine, I said, this gets me out of ever having to do another one ever. And she laughed, and it didn't kind of work. But see, the shaving would have worked. Ah, if only I had known.
Hey, hindsight, you know, like you say, the first time I had to, it was Melissa. And I came home for lunch. And my ex-wife said, could you quick change her? I said, all right. So I go in there, and she forgot to tell me she hadn't been feeling good. You know, you take the diaper off, and you can lift the legs up, and all of a sudden, boom, like a cannon.
Oh, yeah.
Because the diaper changer was in the corner. All over the walls, over me. I just yelled for her. I said, get out of here!
Just hope Mr. Creosote doesn't come along.
Go ahead and jump in the shower because I was literally covered in.
Been there, done that. Oh, yeah. Well, I'm just delighted that my daughter is currently out of town because she'd be calling me up, Dad, you can't talk about that stuff. It's embarrassing to me. How can it be embarrassing to you? We're a child.
My two daughters don't listen to the show.
Yeah, right.
So I'm safe. Of course, their friends might tell her.
Well, that's exactly the problem. Listen, instead of us talking about diapers, why don't you give us a call with a computer question? The number is 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Or, of course, toll free at 1-800-790-0415.
Yeah, because I could always get into telling my usual. Of course, I haven't done it here at this station. It's my great story about my brother and Christmas.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe second half
Maybe
of the hour there.
Next week or whatever.
Yeah, we'll have to get into that.
All right, here we go. We're taking a break. Back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, with Steve Ray, with me, Nick Francesco, and you. You know that you need to give us a call. When we start talking about diapers, you need to give us a call. And you know the numbers, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free at 1-800-790-0415. If you're on the line, please stay on the line. If you're not on the line, I don't know why not. So you can give us a call, but you need to come back in just a couple of minutes. We're going to come back in just a couple of minutes. So if you're on the line, stay on the line. We'll get to you when we come back. With, as I just said, a whole lot more of the longest running computer show in the known universe. We are Soundbites, and we are right here on your favorite radio station in the whole world. Member supported, Jazz 90.1.
Before you call into our show, please make note of the following rules. 1. Turn your radio down. 2. Turn your radio down lower. 3. Remember, nobody has invented a good-sounding speakerphone yet. Don't use them. 4. Make sure you have a point. It makes for a more interesting show. 5. Calling does not guarantee you'll get on the air. No whining. 6. If you do get on the air, please do not tell the host what you just told the screener. We don't care. And 7. Is that radio turned down yet? We hope this will make for a more enjoyable program, and we thank you for your time.
Got a computer question? Call the boys now at 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Or toll free 800-790-0415. Online at soundbites.org. Soundbites continues next on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Welcome back to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites, on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Get online now. Call 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415. Or submit your question by email at soundbites.org. Once again, here's Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
I'm Steve Ray.
And at 5 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites. You know to give us a call. It's 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Or, of course, toll-free at 1-800-790-0415, just like Bill did from Ontario, New York. Welcome, Bill. What's your question?
First of all, I want to apologize. You've probably been over this 10 times because it's a common problem, but I never caught it, and it's a great frustration to me. I'm a music lover. I love your station, etc. And I have just a huge pile of iTunes duplicates. So many of which, I mean, I think I have 4,000 original songs, but I show 12,000 songs.
Oh,
there is a feature in iTunes itself to show duplicates.
I know, but then you got to go through and weed it out. It would take me 3 days to do it.
Well, the danger is what you consider a duplicate may not be a duplicate. It could be two groups singing the same song. That's a duplicate, but not really. So there are several different programs for displaying duplicates. iTunes also has an exact duplicates command, which is more stringent on what it considers a duplicate file. And there's a couple of iTunes scripts for finding duplicates, but most of them come down to, here's what we think are duplicates. Now you have to confirm it because we're not going to delete your files without letting you know.
Right. Well, is there any outstanding program? I'm afraid of getting ripped off. You know, I read some programs, and then the ones that are only available by downloading them as opposed to going to Staples and buying them or whatever.
You're never going to find a commercial program to do this. It's such an easy little utility that you're going to find free programs to download all over the net.
I went to CNET and looked for them. I found Duplicate Cleaner, which did a great job for the rest of my computer, but I wasn't able to make it work within iTunes.
Because iTunes is a database file. It is individual files, but it's the database that tracks all of your files. So you need a program specifically for iTunes. Doug's Apple Scripts has a few different cleaning tools. So if you Google remove iTunes duplicates, you'll find a bunch of them.
Okay.
Now,
okay.
Do you actually have duplicates, or is it that you've put the same song in multiple playlists?
I didn't know that created a problem.
It doesn't. If you put the same song in 10 playlists, the song is only in your library once.
Right.
So you're saying it's actually in the library 10 times.
Yeah, when I go to look for my in my library, I have, for instance, AC/DC, you know, and it'll be a tune on there, and there'll be, you know, anywhere between 3 and 4 of those of the same song. But I would go ahead and find the duplicates and pick them out of there. But I have it for whatever, however it happened. I have, you know, and I have, you know. You know, thousands and thousands and thousands of duplicates.
Right. Yeah.
Now, how many playlists do you have?
I probably have 20.
Would it be easy for him to wipe out the database, reimport all the songs?
Well, the problem
is, then he'd have to rebuild his playlist.
Well, the songs have probably been imported more than once, so they are physically in the library more than once. And there's 2 or 3 different files of the same song. And that's the trick is how much of the same song. Like, you know, even one band can release the same song on multiple albums. So that's why most of the duplicate finders present you a list and say you need to verify. There is a program called TuneUp Media that I have used that works pretty good for cleaning up duplicate songs and for also adding the album artwork, mislabeled MP3 tags, so it does a few different program features like that too. I'm putting the links up for that, and then Doug's Apple Scripts has several different scripts for finding duplicates.
Great. Well, I'll try some of those things, and hopefully we can clean it up.
Yep,
that's the way to do it.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, it's a little annoying because in iPhoto, when you import a duplicate photo, the file name, you know, you're importing from the same camera, so the file name is probably the same, and it can warn you. But when you're importing a song, especially if you didn't import from CD, then the same song can be on different CDs from different artists. If you import the same CD again, it doesn't give you enough of a warning that you've already imported that, and you can easily end up with multiple duplicates of the same song. But now most people catch it before it goes into the thousands.
Right, right, right. Our next caller, Bill from Irondequoit, New York. Welcome, Bill. What's your question?
I have a question about Outlook Express. We've had it crash a couple times in the past couple of weeks. And when I try to shut it off and shut down, they say I have 2 instances of the same program. Or I have another instance open.
Mm-hmm.
That's yeah, that's normal. When it crashes, it didn't quit completely, so there is another instance running.
Okay.
Have you rebooted your system?
Yeah, then you have to reboot the system.
That's it.
It stabilizes it for a little bit, but this has happened 3 or 4 times in the last couple of weeks.
Well, what's likely happened is somewhere along the line, you've gotten either a corrupted email or a malicious email that's trying to take over your system, and it's not working right. Like I said, or you've got just a corrupted email, and whenever Outlook Express passes by that one and attempts to do anything with it, including index it or whatever, it crashes.
Yep. Okay.
So you can try to find it and root it out. You can stop using Outlook Express.
Yeah, go to Thunderbird.
But beyond that, there's not much you can do.
Okay. Well, that's right. I can go to Thunderbird and import into Thunderbird all of
and that that often helps because it will skip over the corrupted ones.
And,
right.
And it's got better junk control. I mean, Outlook Express, you know, sorry, but you know, doesn't do squat.
Yeah, it's not. It's, yeah. It doesn't have very good junk.
You know, you can sit there
spam
and
controls.
You know, mark it as junk and have it automatically throw it to the trash. So you know, it alleviates you having to go through and mark every one of them.
Yep.
I've made extensive use of those filters, and I don't know that I could live without Thunderbird anymore. I mean, I get 1,000 emails a day, and if I didn't have the filtering,
what's the other one that used
built
into we used
Thunderbird?
To use
Eudora?
Yes,
I love
is Eudora. That still around?
It is now. It is now an open source project, and it's actually, I believe, part of the Mozilla suite.
Yeah.
The Mozilla company.
Oh, okay. All right.
So they own Thunderbird and Eudora. And I don't know if they're reissuing Eudora or they're just leaving it as it was.
Yeah, because I've got a couple clients that just, swore by it. You know, you try to move them to any other program, and they said, nope, sorry, I'll stay with this old, old computer. If that's all I can do is, run Eudora, and that's it. I'm happy.
I never liked its address book because it forced you to make a nickname for all your addresses, and I just wanted it to be that person's name. No, you can't do that.
Right. I don't know but I don't know.
Probably not anymore. Well, the intent was you could have Steve Home and Steve Work are two separate address entries.
Right.
And so most address books, you have one contact called Steve and you have Home and Work addresses in them.
Yeah, but I did. I loved Eudora. What a great product that was. And now it's free from Mozilla. So you can have Eudora back again if that's your idea of a good time.
Well,
I may have to try it.
One of the things we should get into is talking about, with the upcoming holidays, Christmas is now, 24 days away?
Well, thank 21. You for ruining my month.
How many days?
Yeah, 21
days.
21
days away.
Yeah. See, I was going to go Christmas shopping this afternoon, but I've got Matthew with me.
Right.
So I guess we'll have to get mommy's presents.
Yeah, thanks. There you go.
But which is the reason she sent Matthew with you, so you'd make sure you shop for her.
But, discuss some of the things. And one of the programs that I've come across, if folks are getting into, Photoshop is, a very expensive program. And another one that I've discovered, which is very inexpensive, but you can even try it out, for free, it's called ArtRage. And it's a great program. It's got a lot of great features in it that you can do some really good paintings and, creating stuff and everything else. And you got stencils and a very versatile program that you can try out for free. And if you want to buy it, it's only like a $40 or $50 program for the professional one. So, give it a look. It's called ArtRage, and I believe it's ArtRage.com.
Steve's going to put up a link to that
now.
Right now.
Yep.
And you
for
should
Windows
give us a call
for Windows and Mac.
You should give us a call and tell
us. And iPad.
And iPad, very nice. You should give us a call and tell us what you'd like for Christmas. I'm sure that your significant other is listening, and it would be a good hint for him or her.
This is the fourth day of Hanukkah, right?
So yes, it is. Or your next Hanukkah present. Our next caller, give us a call 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 1-800-790-0415. Just like Dennis did. From Rochester, New York. Welcome, Dennis. What's your question?
I've got Windows 7, and I once in a while use Internet Explorer as a browser. I mostly use Firefox. When I run Internet Explorer, it knows how to access my Thunderbird email program right in Internet Explorer. When I do Firefox, if I click on an email link, just a bunch of pages open up that keep saying untitled, 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 and they'll just keep going unless I close the browser. I want to know how to get my Thunderbird to work inside Firefox.
Sounds like a helper app isn't set up right to hand off the mail to link.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm looked and I don't see anything to any under tools and I don't see anything to, I'm not sure what to do.
There's an application. I was just in this the other day. Someone had accidentally set iPhoto to open zip files. And so nothing they downloaded would work.
Which version of Firefox do you have?
Okay. It's 3.6.12.
It's gonna be 3. Doggone.
Yeah, I've got it here. Under preferences, under applications, you need to go through the application list. I'm trying to bring it up here on my machine.
I'm trying to figure out where preferences is.
On my machine, on the Mac, it's in the Firefox menu. In Windows, I think it's in the Tools menu.
Okay, Tool Options.
And there's a whole list of file types and helper types. Let me see if it has mail in here to what to do when you click on a mail to.
Oh, now see, this says mail to. Use Thunderbird default. I don't know why. I mean, it's...
So it should be using Thunderbird.
Yeah, but if nothing happens, I wonder why that would be.
Try setting it to something else, saving it and quitting Firefox. Go back into Firefox and set it back to Thunderbird. Maybe there's something corrupt in that preference file.
Okay. All right. I see there's other things here that says always ask, use Gmail, use Yahoo, use other.
Yeah, you can choose which mail program you want to use when you click on a mail link.
Yeah. All right, I'll play around. At least I found that much. I'll play around with that, see how I make out.
Okay, let us know.
Thank you.
All right. It is. It does get a little confusing sometimes. I certainly cannot deny that.
Typically, the last program you install sets all of your other programs to say it's the default. So sometimes that's what you need to do is reinstall Thunderbird, and then mm-hmm. it will tell the system Thunderbird is your default program.
Yep. Or you can go into, for the email, you can go into, for Windows, go into the control panel.
Yeah, Internet Options.
Internet Options of the Program tab. Then under the tab, you can see the one for the email, and you can set it there for Thunderbird to be your default.
Right. That's exactly right. There are also some extensions you can load to help, but you don't need them anymore.
Mm-hmm.
What you just said also... No, maybe that's the wrong way around. In preferences under Thunderbird, you can set it to be the protocol handler, but that does it the other way.
Right.
That goes from Thunderbird to Firefox.
Correct.
So yeah, yep. We're all good there.
Yep.
All right. Oh, I gotta read this. Google's Android continues to grow faster in the U.S. than other top smartphone operating systems, including Research in Motion's BlackBerry OS and Apple's iOS, not the one from Cisco, according to the latest ComScore rankings, which were released Friday. Android subscriber base grew by 6.5 percentage points during the three-month period, while the number of RIM subscribers fell by 3.5%, and Apple's base grew slightly from the three-month period ending in July, a couple of tenths of a percent. Overall, Android ended the latest three-month period in third place behind BlackBerry and iOS, which is not the one from Cisco, it's the one for Apple. Findings are based on a survey of 30,000 mobile phone subscribers aged 13 and older, a ComScore spokes individual said. RIM held a 35.8% market share, down 3.5%. Apple's share grew by just 0.8%, and Google grew by 6%. Microsoft's share of the market, like RIM's, also declined, falling 2.1% in October. Palm, now owned by HP, dropped 1%. The strong showing by Android has been shown in other surveys as well. Many analysts believe Android will be the second most used smartphone operating system worldwide by the end of 2010, behind only Nokia's Symbian OS, which is huge overseas. That finish will put Android-based smartphone sales well ahead of projections made even a year ago. The declines for RIM and Microsoft have also been predicted by many other sources, which leads me to a question that I've wanted to ask for a while. Has anybody got a Windows smartphone? If so, give us a call. Tell us what you think of it. 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Or toll free 1-800-790-0415. Back in just a couple of minutes, Dave, Steve, me, Nick, and you. It's 21 minutes after the hour. It's Soundbites on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Computer talk you can understand. More Sound Bites is next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
And I'm Dave Henry.
I'm Steve Ray.
And at 25 minutes after the hour, I'm depressed.
Why?
We have this whole new system here where if there's certain number of seconds of silence,
mm-hmm.
we get the light going off and all this stuff happens.
So let's be silent for 10 seconds.
And Dave won't let me all right, then. Instead, we'll go back to the phones, and we'll talk to Chuck from Penfield.
Thank you.
No offense to you, Chuck. What can we do for you today?
Hey, guys. I was upgrading my BIOS today, and I was flashing it in Windows, and the computer locked up.
Ouch.
And now it's a brick.
Uh-oh. Yep, it is.
Yep. Good doorstop.
I can't get it to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
What you need to do is to bring it to somebody like Dave who might be able to do something.
No,
you need you need to pull the BIOS chip out and replace it with
a good
BIOS chip.
Yeah, and those are usually surface mounted and 10 to 1 odds.
If it's a new motherboard, that's true. That's absolutely
You might as well just go looking for a new motherboard.
Okay. Thank you.
Didn't Mr. BIOS used to have, well, if it's surface mounted, yeah, there's really nothing you can do.
That's back
about
in
it.
The day. I mean, I haven't seen BIOS modules that you've been able to pull in, I bet you, 10 years.
Yeah.
I mean, even going back to the Windows XP days, I mean, they stopped doing that. It was back in the 486 days that you could sit there and pull the chip out because that was the big thing. And, folks, if you're the least bit leery, doing the BIOS update, please don't. This is something you really have to follow step by step. And if you screw it up, and it's the only polite way to put it.
It may not be your fault. You know, the computer could crash. The power could fail.
It could. It just hiccup. If you're not ready to accept the what happens, consequences, you're going to call a previous caller. You're going to wind up with a brick.
You may be able to call your motherboard manufacturer and get a replacement for it, but they're probably going to charge you for it since it wasn't a warranty failure. It was, unless you can claim.
If somebody called and said, I'm having this problem, and they said, download this and flash the BIOS, maybe then. Maybe.
Well, your story used to have about the error message that popped up and said, call tech support.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, we're going to have to remove that from the code. We don't want you calling us.
But that is, I mean, of all the things, you know, that's right up there with which we will never do here on this show is recommend folks going into the registry and playing around. Right. Because I don't want to be responsible for, you know.
Right, when you screw it up, and it's not an if, it's a when.
Oh, yeah.
We don't want to be.
Well, I've also had folks call and sit there and say, well, could you walk me through it? No. Yes, granted, it's a procedure I could probably do, but if I'm not sitting right there and seeing the screen and knowing, because some folks, God love them, they get impatient, and they start, keep hitting the button, you know, and all of a sudden they lock the machine up, and then that causes more issues that, no, I don't want any part of that. If you want to go around and play in the registry, all I can say is back up.
Yeah, you better really know what you're doing and have an amazing amount of patience in a second computer when this one stops working.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I get in trouble sometimes at work because I try to talk people through what I think are simple things on the phone. Mm. And they don't tell you they didn't understand the question.
Mm-hmm.
Or they didn't understand the answer. You know, go to the Apple menu and open system preferences.
Or they're not...
They don't know. You
but
know,
Steve, what they'll do is
they don't tell you they're not following along.
Right. They'll usually try to get six steps ahead of you instead of being patient. And well, what about the don't follow along with me? You know, if we're trying to walk through them, and if they get too impatient, it's like, well, tell you what, maybe it's just better that you bring it in, because some folks just don't have the patience.
Yeah, we're done now.
Yeah, to slowly go along and do it.
Yeah, it takes a lot of patience. You want to be methodical. You want to be slow.
You want
to think through every step twice.
Or they go off and
you've done it.
And they go off in other tangents. Well, what about this? Let's stay focused on this. We'll get this, and then because they're already thinking of six other things that they want to also do while they have us on the phone.
And usually, they preface every answer with, "I don't know much about computers."
Yeah.
Well, then I'm not going to be able to talk you through it anyway.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Good point.
Almost worse is I know everything about computers. We'll go to the menu.
Oh, no, that's worse.
Yeah. Go to the file menu and choose print. Where's that?
Yep.
In the menu bar.
Oops.
Where's that?
Yep.
At the top of the window. Where's that? But I know everything about computers.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah.
I can't tell you how many times I used to get that one.
We get a lot of people who have switched from Windows into the Mac because we're primarily a Mac shop. And they always say that. Well, I haven't used the Mac very much. I've been using Windows for years. It's 99% identical. You have Windows and icons and menus and a cursor. Mm-hmm. It's on the other side of the screen because Microsoft didn't want to get sued, and that didn't work.
The big thing that screws up people moving from Windows to Mac is that closing a window doesn't close the program.
Right, because you didn't tell the program to close. You just told the window to close.
Right, and on the Mac, you understand that. But on Windows, people don't understand that. And if they don't have a lot of memory, they've got 15, right. 20, 30 programs all running, and yep. you run out of memory, the machine.
Yeah, they wonder why things
somehow
won't
it's
run.
The fault
yeah.
of the computer.
And that was a problem in the early Windows world, because quitting and relaunching the apps over and over and over again
caused memory leaks.
Caused memory leak and yep, crashed your yep, stacks. Yep. And you had that heap overflow and stack overflow errors.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Whew, back in the day.
All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Jim from Greece, New York. Welcome, Jim. What's your question?
I've got a problem, and I think it's probably the battery in my uninterruptible power supply. I've got my printer plugged into a surge protector, and my uninterruptible power supply plugged into that surge protector, and the computer plugged into the uninterruptible power supply. That's hard to say. And when I turn on that power supply to turn on the printer, it knocks the computer off, shuts it off.
Yeah, here's the thing. The UPS should not be plugged into the surge protector. It is already right. a surge protector.
That should go directly into the wall.
Yeah,
right.
I was just sort of using it as an extension.
No, and here's why you don't want to do that, because that UPS should be constantly recharging the battery from the wall. And if you've got it mm-hmm. in the surge protector and you turn that surge protector off,
ain't doing its job.
It's not doing its job. In addition, if you've got any sort of surge that comes through one, it's not going to be protected from the other. It's not. That's not what it's for. You should plug the computer into the UPS, plug the UPS into the wall. There's your surge protection for the computer.
Okay.
If you want surge protection for the printer, then you plug that into your power bar there, your surge protector power bar, and plug that into a different outlet.
A lot of times the UPSs will have, say, two banks of outlets. One is surge protection only, and one is battery backup. So your printer you don't need on the battery backup, so you plug that just into the surge suppress side of it.
Right. It depends on what kind of UPS you have.
Mm-hmm. Right. So if you turn on something and something else turns off, that probably means you're pulling too much power out of the surge, the UPS. So if your UPS is rated for 300 watts, and say you've got a 300-watt computer and you turn on your 100-watt printer, it can't push it all. So you may need to get a bigger UPS.
Well, I wouldn't
or
even
not put the, I wouldn't well, put
yeah,
the printer,
don't put
in
the printer
UPS.
On
the
UPS.
No,
yes,
the printer
anyway.
Shouldn't be on. The only thing that should be on that UPS is the computer, the monitor. That's it.
Yep.
I've taken to put my
and a backup my backup unit
my cable router and my LAN router on the UPS. So
right.
when power goes out, I can still get my laptops on the internet.
Right. But beyond that, no. I wouldn't, you know, you need to do some rewiring.
Yep.
Okay.
And that should help.
Very good. Thank you very much.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
If it were the battery in the UPS, everything would still work except when the power failed. So even if the battery is dead, the UPS should still work.
And if the battery is dead, you should be getting a siren and a light.
Yeah.
Until
it gives up. Does it ever give up?
I don't.
I've seen some of the APCs.
I've never waited, frankly. When I start hearing that noise, I replace the battery. So
we've gotten calls like that. There's this weird chirping coming from my desk. Well, check your UPS. There's probably a warning light on it.
Yep.
Odd noise. It's just like your car. You learn what the good mm-hmm. noises are and the normal noises are, and when you hear unnormal noises, you go.
Right. All right, our next caller is Richard from Irondequoit. Welcome, Richard. What's your question?
Hi, guys. I've got a Toshiba Cosmio 05. Paid a ton of money for it. And I've got 11 thread-like lines vertical up and down throughout the screen, different colors. Whatever I'm playing, whatever's on, whether I'm online or not or watching a movie, these thread-like colors are always there. There's 11 of them. It increased from a few to 11. Yellow, purple, green.
Yeah, something's failing. It could be the video cable going from the computer to the monitor, or it could be the LCD panel itself.
Yep.
Everything inside the computer, though. Nothing I can... You said a cable.
If this thing is still under warranty, call right now.
Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely call right now.
Yeah, that
now.
Monitor probably is going to have to be replaced.
I've seen sometimes where it's just the cable and not the LCD panel.
Right. The problem with laptops
because the cable,
is that cable has to go through the hinge.
Yeah.
And if What really makes me crazy are the people who pick up their computers by the screen.
Not me.
No, I understand that. I'm not saying you. But in general, what that means is people who pick it up by the screen, either on the side or on the top, what they're doing is putting a lot of lateral pressure on that hinge, and it could damage the cable.
And in
some of them, just the simple act of building it gets that cable crimped, and it starts to wear away as you open and close the lid.
Especially if you can make the pattern of lines change by opening and closing the lid.
They're the same pattern, same distance apart, which is to say the distance apart is not the same.
Right.
Yeah,
it's probably the screen, and if it's under warranty, you call today.
Yep. A lot of times the screens are all now one sealed unit because everything is glued together, so you can't replace the cable. Yeah, it's a $20 cable, but it's a $600 screen, and you have to replace the whole screen.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Lately, though, maybe this has something to do with it, when I power up my computer, Windows now wants me to press Control Alt Delete and then enter a password. Never did that before. Can I get rid of that?
Yeah, you've got to go into the
BIOS. You can,
BIOS,
but you shouldn't.
The BIOS 7.
Well, no, this is Windows asking for a password? Or the
Windows XP.
So
it's Windows XP Media Center Edition asking for me to hit Control Alt Delete, which I do, and then it wants a password.
Right. You can go into your control panel and tell it to save the password for you, but generally speaking, you want it to stop and ask for a password, so if someone else gets their hands on your computer, they don't get your stuff.
This is a very expensive toy, so that really isn't a concern.
Well, then go into the control panel under users, and you can change the logon procedure.
To not require a password.
Yeah. To not prompt you for that.
Basically, it's saving.
Say that once more, sir.
You go into the control panel under users, and in the users, you can change the logon procedure.
Ah.
So that's what you want to go there.
Have you guys ever heard of Media Center Edition?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
You never mentioned it at all, and I always thought it was kind of hokey, but maybe I'm not using it right.
No, it's fine. When we talk about Windows XP, we generally just talk about generic Windows XP.
Because
problems are the same across versions.
Yeah, there's no really different. All the media did was add some other media features. I mean, it was nothing really, big and other stuff.
Some of the media centers.
Television, big deal.
Right. So the media centers typically had a TV tuner in them, sometimes a radio tuner. And the media center software has been rolled into Windows in general and Vista and 7. So they don't even make that distinction anymore.
Okay.
Right. Back in the day when people didn't have DVRs and everything else, that was a pretty big deal.
I guess so.
Yep.
One more question.
Yep.
You guys mentioned a while back that Windows was not supporting XP, but just now when I turned my laptop on, they loaded me Service Pack 3.
Right. Service Pack 3 is the only thing they are supporting for a couple more years.
That's the last big update that you will see. That's the last Service Pack.
They just gave it to me today. I'm wondering, is it new or not?
No.
It's 2 years old.
Yeah. That's been out there. You might have gotten some warnings because of the additional.
So how new is this laptop?
2005.
Oh, so it is an older laptop.
No, you really should have gotten that before now.
I did run the security tango yesterday. Maybe it helped a little along. So
yeah, you should have gotten the Service Pack 3 update a couple years ago.
Interesting. Thanks, guys.
Sure. Okay. Sure.
Bye.
Yeah, so Service Pack 2 support ended July of this year. Service Pack 3 support goes until July.
Hope it was a legitimate Service Pack 3 request.
Yeah, that's true. July 2014, I think it is when XP Service Pack 3 ends.
All right, we're going to take a break. We will be back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco, and each and every one of you. Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ, 966-5299, toll-free 1-800-790-0415. You're listening to Soundbites right here on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
It's America's longest-running computer show. Back to more Soundbites with Nick, Dave, and Steve, next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
I'm Steve Ray.
And at 43 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites. Light and free apps are a big part of the iPhone App Store. But similar demos and trial versions won't be welcome in Apple's App Store for Mac. Yes, there's going to be an App Store for Mac. The apps you submit to be reviewed for the Apple... I should probably read this in a German accent. The apps you submit to be reviewed for the Mac App Store should be fully functional retail versions of your apps, Apple said in an announcement to developers. If developers want to give away demos, trials, or beta versions of their software, they'll have to do it somewhere else, like their own websites. Apple announced the Mac App Store in late October. Research shows that free apps account for 3/4 of all iOS, not the one from Cisco, App Store downloads, despite making up only 1/4 of all apps in the store. Further research shows that freemium apps, which are initially free but offer paid versions or upgrades, have become a successful business model. Free apps account for 1/3 of the iPhone's top grossing apps. The Mac App Store could thrive on cheap, free, simple software. A desktop version of Angry Birds, I'm sure, would do quite well. But free apps give people an added incentive to go bargain hunting. In exchange for a Mac store that only sells paid apps, Apple could sacrifice some of the foot traffic that iOS's storefront enjoys, not the one from Cisco. The Mac App Store is expected to launch by the end of January. So, free, freemium, or paid? What type of app entices you to buy? Give us a call. 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Or, of course, toll-free 1-800-790-0415. Just like George did from all the way out in Greece, New York. Welcome, George. What's your question?
Hey, that's a great intro.
Thanks.
I was listening earlier, and I got called away from being able to listen on the radio, but you were talking about flash drives and they being infected.
Yes, yes.
I would like to be able to take a flash drive and put on a couple of charts from Excel and take it to a person and have them use it in their computer in front of a group.
Right.
What can I do to assure that flash drive and the content that I put on there are safe for him to use?
Well, I've been saying, though.
Assure nothing.
Right. No, right.
You can take reasonable precautions of running antivirus and anti-malware computer.
No, instead of a flash drive, just give it to him on a CD.
Well, no, if it's infected on his computer, it will be infected on the CD. And then when he opens it on the other computer.
But if he's sure that it's not.
Right, yeah. So you have to make
sure. You can burn it to CD. Otherwise, like I was saying before, you can get these flash drives now, and they take an SD card. Now, the beauty of an SD card is you can pull the SD card out, and it has, like the old floppies, a locking mechanism. Yeah. That is the only thing we use in our shop. I will not use any flash drives that do not have a locking system on them.
Yeah, the danger to you is that when that person gives the flash drive back to you, if their machine was infected, the drive is now infected and could reinfect you. So by locking the flash drive, it can't be infected at the other end.
Okay, I understand that. And at the moment, I'm not concerned about what comes back to me. I'm most concerned in giving assurance to the person I'm handing the flash drive to.
Well, then you've got to do due diligence and make sure that you know your machine is clean. You know, you've run the Tango and everything else. That when you go to burn them to a flash drive, you know, you put it to a flash drive, or you give it to them on a CD.
Now, let me back up a step then. Mm-hmm. I'm following most of what you're saying. Mm-hmm. When you say an infected flash drive, if I clear the contents of the flash drive, if I wipe it all out, and then put on, let's say, one chart from Excel,
all right.
Can the chart be infected?
Yes. I mean, if your machine is infected, that's what I'm saying. It doesn't matter whether you wipe the flash drive off. If your machine is infected, you can go ahead and wipe that flash drive 20 times or until the cows come home. Mm-hmm. But if your machine is infected and you're moving it, it's going to, chances are it could move over there with it.
Now, I understand that, but I had the impression that most of the infections were in things like email and other types of...
Infections are in documents. Whether you get that document through email or through a website or through a disk, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, there's... Okay.
Now, let's do one other step then. Mm-hmm. If I hand him the drive and say, look, and he would know that my computer generally is not an infected computer, but is there anything he can do to purge the infection?
He can scan the drive on his computer before he opens the file.
Okay. And he would scan that with?
Whatever
programs he's using.
Any virus and any malware scanners.
So that would be Synanic or...
McAfee, Norton, AVG, Malwarebytes, Super AnySpyware, the whole list in the Tango.
Because I think he's with an organization that would have a lot of talent able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So he would be pretty sure then there's no risk.
Right.
Correct.
Some businesses
on his side of it.
Yep. If some they take the time to do it.
Right. Yeah. Well, some businesses that are really concerned about security won't accept flash drives because of the potential risk involved.
Even if they go through the scrubbing?
Yeah, depends. Again, depends on the, you know, the company.
Well, because the users don't do the scrubbing is the problem. So the company has a blanket wide ban on flash drives.
Okay. But if I give it to him with the understanding that he would do that and he would say, no, we won't do it, or mm-hmm. we will do it,
yeah.
I know where we stand.
You got right. it.
Okay.
And most of the anti-malware programs will scan disks and files on open unless the computer's already infected. And then it can't and won't scan again, and then will infect that disk again, and when it comes back to you, it will have an infection on it.
Okay. I won't take the time now, but I want to call back another time and talk about something called U-Lock or some feature on SanDisk, which I thought was a locking feature, but let's take that up another time.
Well, yep.
Thank you very much.
Yep.
All right, thanks.
I mean, you know, there's still... like I said, that's the only reason that I've, you know, did away. You know, the flash drives are great, you know, and they're a handy tool. I mean, you can shove so much stuff on it compared to a floppy and everything else. But that's where I say we've gotten a little complacent in that, you know, the folks just hand them around so freely. Oh, here, yeah, take this off there. I'm going to scan it first. Oh, why? I ain't gonna take a chance. Yeah, hello. It could be.
I carry an 8 gig flash drive around with me all the time, but I don't put it in anybody else's computer. It's for me to transport files from work to home and back.
You
want
to plug that in?
No, I don't.
See, here's mine.
So we're all pulling our flash drives out of our pocket. God,
for folks,
geeks.
You know, that are watching on. This is what one looks like. You can see it on the camera. There's the USB part. And then under here, the other part, is where I can pull off. Mm-hmm. I've got it taped. The SD card is in there, and I've got a 4 gig. I mean, I can store a heck of a lot of stuff. But I know that when I go to a client, one, I'm not going to be giving him any viruses or Trojans, and I'm sure as hell not picking anything up from his machine. So I can safely put this in there.
That's the big thing. Right?
Yeah, I mean, I can't take the liability. You know, I mean, I go into some companies and that, you know, I could be getting real big trouble, you know, all of a sudden carrying a virus and, well, maybe you brought, nope, no way. I can emphatically say, you know, anytime I go in, you didn't get it from me. There's no way, impossible.
Several of the flash drive companies have software locks that they put onto the flash drives now, but very few of them have the hardware lock anymore.
PDI, PQI, maybe, is supposed to have one, but I don't.
You know, that's what gets me. You know, how much more? How much more?
Yeah.
There was one
half a penny, and when you sell 100 million of them, that adds up.
And there was a company out there for a while that had a few of the flash drives. You know, they were smaller ones.
Right.
128s and 256 meg.
Right.
You know, they're small, but like you say, to just add that little toggle, this little slider switch on the circuit board to lock it. No biggie.
Yeah, now it's when they talk about locked or protected flash drives, they're talking about encrypted and password protected.
Right, right. You specifically want to look for write protect flash drives, but they're very rare, and that is too bad.
Yeah, because folks are getting confused on that too, the encryption. The encryption is passwords and that type of stuff. Does
or
it mean
thumbprint or whatever on the flash drive, right?
Because there's other stuff that can still get on there, even though the encryption is in there. All the encryption does mean, excuse me, is that, I can't get into those particular files because I have to know the code to get into it. It doesn't mean that other viruses and Trojans can't also reside on that flash drive. And this is where folks are getting misled very easily because they think, it's protected. No, it's not.
Right. It's protected from the casual user getting at your private data, but it's not protected from viruses and things like that from corrupting the machine itself because they can still attach themselves to things, and when you go in and try to use it, you get re-corrupted. So I'm a big fan of not ever using anybody else. I'm on Linux, it's easier, and I can certainly scan anything before I move on, because unless it's a Linux-specific environment or virus, mm-hmm. it's not going to jump across right. at all anyway.
Correct.
But even so, I tend to err on the side
better,
of caution.
It's better to. I mean, nowadays with so much stuff, I mean, we see so much stuff coming through the shop, and especially right now with the holidays, you know, you got to be super careful.
Right. Particularly since it's no longer a matter of you did something stupid or you did something wrong. Just in the simple act of browsing the web, you can catch a virus. So these things happen all over the place, and you have to be a lot more careful. All right. Somehow you've wasted 2 more hours of your life listening to us. Thank you so much for doing so. You need to stay tuned both here and our website and our Facebook page, because we have an interesting announcement coming up shortly. We'll be talking about that.
Big announcement coming up.
Yeah, but for the moment, we are done for another week. We want to thank all those of you who called in. We want to apologize to those of you to whom we did not get. Next week, call earlier. That's the easy way to solve that problem. For Dave Enright, for Steve Ray, I'm Nick Francesco. Thanks so much for listening. We're the longest running computer show in the known universe. Sound Bites, right here on the truly great member-supported Jazz 90.1.